This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Tom Perata, wrote the novels Election and Little Children, which were both adapted into films. His new novel, The Leftovers, starts with this premise. What if suddenly millions of people instantaneously vanished in a scenario similar to but definitely different from the Rapture? The novel is about those people left on Earth, or as the title puts it, the leftovers. Perata writes about how they cope with grief and loss, and why some see this as an act of God and believe it's the start of the end times, while others struggle to find ways to live with the inexplicable. Tom Perata is in the process of adapting The Leftovers for HBO. His previous novel, The Abstinence Teacher, was about the culture wars, focusing on a sex education teacher who's pressured to teach abstinence only. Terry spoke with Perata earlier this week.
Tom Perata, welcome back to Fresh Air. Your book isn't about the rapture per se, but to understand what's in the book, you have to understand what beliefs about the rapture are. So why don't we start with that? What is your understanding of the rapture?
Well, the rapture is part of premillennial end times theology. It's actually a pretty recent part of Christianity. I think it was a 19th century invention or formulation, and it's the beginning of the second coming, which is a 7-year period. So basically, the rapture is the first real occasion the Christians on earth rise to meet Jesus in the sky, and the people who are left behind suffer through a 7-year period of tribulation, which is wars, plagues, all kinds of suffering. And there's a big battle that involves the Antichrist and Armageddon, and finally the second coming and the millennium, which is Christ's kingdom on earth for 1,000 years.
So in the rapture, the believers rise to heaven and the non-believers stay behind and have to deal with the tribulations, the plagues and floods and all that.
Exactly.
Okay. So I want you to read an excerpt of the prologue to your novel, The Leftovers. And this is from the point of view of Lori, who's an agnostic who lives with her husband. They have 2 children, a boy in college and a girl in high school. She never believed in the rapture. She says it always seemed like religious kitsch to her, kind of like one of those black velvet paintings. And then she's kind of hit with the fact that all these people have disappeared. So why don't you pick it up from there?
Okay. Then it happened. The biblical prophecy came true, or at least partly true. People disappeared, millions of them at the same time, all over the world. This wasn't some ancient rumor, a dead man coming back to life during the Roman Empire, or a dusty homegrown legend, Joseph Smith unearthing golden tablets in upstate New York, conversing with an angel. This was real. The rapture happened in her hometown, to her best friend's daughter, among others, while Lori herself was in the house. God's intrusion into her life couldn't have been any clearer if he'd addressed her from a burning azalea. At least you would have thought so. And yet she managed to deny the obvious for weeks and months afterward, clinging to her doubts like a life preserver, desperately echoing the scientists and pundits and politicians who insisted that the cause of what they called the sudden departure remained unknown, and cautioned the public to avoid jumping to conclusions until the release of the official report by the nonpartisan government panel that was investigating the matter. Something tragic occurred, the experts repeated over and over. It was a rapture-like phenomenon, but it doesn't appear to have been the rapture. Interestingly, some of the loudest voices making this argument belonged to Christians themselves, who couldn't help noticing that many of the people who disappeared on October 14th, Hindus and Buddhists and Muslims and Jews, and atheists, and animists, and homosexuals, and Eskimos, and Mormons, and Zoroastrians, whatever the heck they were, hadn't accepted Jesus Christ as their personal savior. As far as anyone could tell, it was a random harvest. And the one thing the rapture couldn't be was random. The whole point was to separate the wheat from the chaff, to reward the true believers, and put the rest of the world on notice. An indiscriminate rapture was no rapture at all. So it was easy enough to be confused, to throw up your hands and claim that you just didn't know what was going on. But Lori knew. Deep in her heart, as soon as it happened, she knew. She'd been left behind. They all had. It didn't matter that God hadn't factored religion into his decision-making. If anything, that just made it worse, more of a personal rejection. And yet she chose to ignore this knowledge, to banish it to some murky recess of her mind, the basement storage area for things you couldn't bear to think about, the same place you hid the knowledge that you were going to die so you could live your life without being depressed every minute of every day.
And that's Tom Perrotta reading from his new novel, The Leftovers. So at the center of this is the idea, if something inexplicable happened, would you attribute it to God, or would you find a scientific, secular reason to explain it? Who believes this is an act of God? Who believes it's some kind of scientific or just inexplicable phenomena that is not related to religion? Why did you want to pose that question in your novel?
Well, that's a very good question. I think when you write a book, you start, I think, in a much vaguer place. You're not really sure what question you're posing. So in this case, I think I wrote a book called The Abstinence Teacher. It was my last novel, and it was about the culture wars in the U.S. and centered around sex education. And I spent a lot of time thinking about contemporary Christianity and reading about it. And obviously the rapture kept coming up, and my first impulse was to sort of laugh it off. It's a sort of a funny idea, people just floating away. But I also kept thinking, well, what if it did happen? What, you know, I'm such a skeptic that I think even if it did happen, I thought I would resist the implications of it. And I also thought 3 years later, everyone would have forgotten about it, that no matter what horrible thing happens in the world, the culture seems to move on and keep flowing into the present moment. And so the more I thought about it, the more it seemed like a really rich metaphor for thinking about the way that we react to, as you say, incomprehensible events, horrible events, things that we can't completely understand. There are these dueling impulses, you know, to remember and bear witness and to forget and move on. And this was the scenario that I chose to explore those impulses.
Now, your book is being published very close to the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And in a way, that seems like no coincidence, because I kept thinking about 9/11 when reading your book, because many people in New York, you know, did disappear. They disappeared into the rubble of the towers. Their remnants, their remains were never found.
And you know, I certainly was thinking about it as I wrote it. I didn't write the book as a kind of direct response to 9/11, but I did keep getting hung up on this idea of 7 years, and that's the period of the tribulation mentioned in End Times Theology. And I kept thinking, you know, 7 years is such a long time. You know, I remember 10 years ago feeling like, you know, the world will never be the same. We'll never forget this. And I think, you know, even 4 and 5 years later, it started to seem like something that had already been absorbed by history, that we had moved past it. Now, obviously, for people who were directly affected, it's never absorbed by history. It's always present. And so it was one of the really contemporary examples I had of this process. But you can name any number of traumatic 20th century events and think about, you know, how quickly many people managed to move on.
The mother in the book, whose point of view we heard represented in the reading that you did, she joins this cult-like group called the Guilty Remnant. Would you describe the group?
The Guilty Remnant represents a very extreme reaction to this event, the rapture, or the sudden departure. These people are kind of a homegrown suburban cult. They dress in white, and that makes them distinctive. They travel in same-sex pairs throughout the town. But the thing that makes them most distinctive is that they are smoking constantly. This is a sort of declaration of faith, and also a sense that they have that there's no future, that they don't have to worry about their health or anything like that. And what they do is just follow people around, and they see themselves as living reminders. They devote themselves to bearing witness. And there is this guilty sense. They believe that they were in some way rejected by God. They're not they don't necessarily identify as Christians, but they have absorbed that viewpoint on the rapture, that they were, in a sense, left behind, judged and found wanting, and they dedicate themselves to preventing a return to normalcy in the town.
Yeah, and they're living with the idea that being alive on Earth is more of a punishment than a gift.
It's true, and yet the biblical context for that, the wars and the disasters, hasn't really occurred. And so what they have is a kind of voluntary renunciation of the world. And so they're eating very badly, and they're sort of hungry all the time. And there's a scene, for instance, where Laurie ends up in the supermarket, and it's almost more than she can take. And she sees it as, you know, this garden from which she and everyone else has been expelled, but not everyone seems to know that.
Do you know why the people in your own novel disappeared?
No. I didn't. Partly, I'm always impatient in science fiction movies or books where there's this explanation. Well, there was a temporary disturbance in the Earth's magnetic field.
Or, yeah.
You know, tons of industrial waste were dumped into the river, and that's why this monster was created. I understand that there may be social criticism embedded in those sort of explanations, but they always seem kind of cheap and easy. And in any case, for me, the book was really about the experience of not knowing. As I say, I'm a skeptic myself, or an agnostic, whatever word you want to put on. And I do feel like, you know, the burden of living with that sort of skepticism is that you are confronted with not having a story about why terrible things happen, or, you know, what the meaning is of our time on Earth. And so to me, you know, and the apocalyptic religious stories are always about imposing a final meaning on the mysteries of life. And this is an agnostic's apocalypse where even this event that should make everything clear just makes it all murky.
Did you grow up with religion?
Yes, I grew up Catholic in the 1970s, and it was not a very rigorous religious upbringing. I mean, I stayed in the church right up to the point where I got confirmed at age 13, and that was basically what we did. It was like, just stay in, get confirmed. It was almost like I graduated from church.
Right. So you didn't even need to have a falling out. You just graduated.
Yeah, you didn't have to go anymore.
But knowing what you know about Roman Catholicism, and then having done some studying of evangelical Christianity for this book and also for your previous book, The Abstinence Teacher, what are some of the differences that you see between the two approaches to faith?
Well, that's sort of an enormous question. I mean, the thing that most struck me in you know, studying evangelical culture for The Abstinence Teacher was just how crucial the Bible was, and one's own reading of the Bible and one's understanding of the Bible, and one's personal choices. And I don't remember feeling like, you know, the Catholic Church was encouraging one to independently read the Bible. I'm sure that people are going to... People who are Catholics now will tell me that I'm wrong about some of these things. But this was my own experience at the time. It felt somewhat... It was more, I guess I should say, I was raised in the kind of Catholic culture rather than as a, you know, religious person. So, it was not... I was not encouraged to read the Bible or make, you know, very personal religious choices.
Since you're not someone who turns to the Bible for explanations about life and death and other mysteries, do you find that the fiction is helpful in, if not comprehending the world, at least finding people who help explain living in the face of mystery?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would probably have to say that reading fiction, those stories fill the space that, you know, other people might use religious stories for. You know, the bulk of what I know about human life I've gotten from novels. And I think the thing about novels that make them important to the people who love them is that there's always another perspective. There's no novel that I think really works unless it has a kind of internal dialogue and attention. And I think that is obviously, you know, a real alternative to religion, which tends to give you a unified perspective and isn't that interested in the idea that there are competing ideas that are equally valid or valid if you are a person in a, you know, one set of circumstances and less valid if you're a person in another set of circumstances. It's very relative in that sense, and as opposed to absolute, and that's what drives, you know, religious conservatives crazy. They don't like this idea that there are multiple truths for multiple people.
One of the characters in your novel, this is the daughter in the main family. She thinks about how easy it is to romanticize the missing. And somebody who, one of her friends, disappears during this rapture-like experience. And everybody assumes that they're best friends and that that Jill, the daughter, must be in a terrible state of grief. But Jill and this other girl, it turns out, really weren't close. It's their mothers who were very close, and she didn't even like her all that much. So all these like feelings of grief are being projected on her that she doesn't quite feel. And she also thinks about, in romanticizing the dead, how her friend would be described, you know, that God missed her blue eyes and her beautiful smile and wanted her company. And I was wondering if you've been to funerals or memorials where you felt that the person who was deceased was being romanticized in ways that weren't honest.
I think that part happens all the time, and sometimes it happens the other way, where people's lives are just reduced and their complexity is reduced. And I think, you know, what Jill is trying to figure out is, you know, how do you hold on to the truth of your life at this moment when, you know, everybody, as you say, is projecting things onto her. She's what's called an eyewitness in the world of the novel. She happened to be there when someone disappears, and eyewitnesses have a sort of privileged place in the hierarchy of grief. But she feels that just as the disappeared person, Jen, is being sort of unfairly glorified by the language of grief, I think she also feels that her own experience is being erased. You know, she wasn't that close with Jen. She doesn't want to live the rest of her life, or at least the next few years, being thought of as, you know, the girl who lost her best friend. And so she's really, in her own mind, just saying, she wasn't my best friend. I didn't even like her. She was mean to me. And you know, to me, it's just there's this impulse to make the past simpler and easier to hold on to, and this impulse to hold on to the complexity of our experience. And to me, that is, you know, the way to respect life and the way to respect an individual is to try and remember them in their complexity.
You know, when I first opened your new novel, The Leftovers, I was kind of expecting it to be a social satire about the rapture and people who believed it. And I don't think that's what it is. I mean, there are satirical elements in it, but I think what you're really doing is looking at why some people believe, why some people don't believe, how we live in the face of mystery, how we grieve for people who we've lost. Can you talk a little bit about the tone you wanted and the tone you wanted to use to describe those people who do believe in the rapture?
Yeah, no, that's I'm really glad you said that, because I don't feel like I'm a satirist. I don't even think I ever was, but that label has stuck to me, probably because the movie Election was a brilliant satire, and it kind of amped up some elements that were muted in the book to do that. And that was the first way people became familiar with my work. And so labels tend to stick, and first impressions tend to stick. But I will say that I think what happens for me is that I do start in a place that feels like it might lead to a satire. And then the process of spending time with characters, getting inside their heads, trying to see the world the way they see it, pulls me away from satire. So, and I think a lot of times, you know, you can't see where you're going to end up. So I think I did, if you asked me the day I started writing this book, I think I would have told you that it was going to be a lot funnier than it turned out to be. The problem was to choose the rapture as your subject matter means that you're dealing with characters who are grieving for the missing. And the story is the story of an epidemic of grief and loss. And if there's a religious impulse in the book, it's, to me, you know, what must have been the original religious impulse, which is, you know, the faith is a response to incomprehensible loss. And so I don't think that any of the characters who embrace the various faiths that are available in the book are ridiculous. I think that that feeling of loss and that need for comfort is a completely human response to what's happened.
So your new novel, The Leftovers, is being adapted into an HBO series. Are you working on the adaptation?
Yeah, I'm going to write the pilot.
So what are you going to have to do to make this into television?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the book has an interesting time frame. It basically does not focus on the rapture-like event that's at the center of it. It begins about some months after it happens, and the bulk of the action takes place 3 years after the event. So, you know, one of the things I'm really pondering is just where do I begin my story? And the thing I love about serial TV drama is that you can really let a story breathe. And, you know, when you're adapting a book for a film, a feature film that's 2 hours, you're just always compressing and cutting. And I think what TV offers you is the ability to maybe open things up, take events that are just mentioned in passing in the novel and develop them. So I'm really thinking that there's a lot of material that takes place in this 3 year period that I kind of skip over, that I might be able to, you know, break open and explore and let breathe.
Tom Perrotta, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry. I really enjoyed it.
Tom Perrotta speaking with Terry Gross. His new novel is called The Leftovers. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Two experimental rock bands, Battles and Cheer Accident, have recently put out new albums. Critic Milo Miles says these bands have found ways to increase their popular appeal while staying close to their roots.
The anti-pop element in rock and roll began in the late 60s with groups like Emerson, Lake & Palmer and Henry Cow, and continued right through the 90s with performers like Nick Cave and Nine Inch Nails. All were compelled to make rock more noisy and intricate rather than catchy or sensual. The results have been mixed at best. Far too many albums that appeal to true believers but feel distant, even alienating to everyone else. But there's always been grand exceptions like Sonic Youth, who began abrasive but discovered their own way to go pop and still be themselves. With enough effort, they forged hooks, melodies, even beauty in their own idiom. And following a similar path, two bands coming from very different directions have recently put out their most appealing, yet still cerebral, records. The New York trio called Battles consists of guitarist and keyboardist Ian Williams, bassist and guitarist Dave Konopka, and drummer John Stainier. It's a sort of supergroup, though only Stainier's previous band, Helmet, had a national profile. Battles originally featured vocalist and multi-instrumentalist Ty Braxton, but his return to solo projects has been good for the group because their second album, Gloss Drop, is far less cluttered and fussy than their debut. Why, the first single, Ice Cream, is almost friendly in a bristly way. Gloss Drop includes several guest vocalists, but they're afterthoughts, textures among the textures, and not the bearers of messages or stories. But even without catchphrases, you quickly come to recognize every track on the album when you hear it again, and you want to replay it. Although Battles are full of current ideas, they offer one of the oldest fascinations of rock and roll. You don't know quite what it is, but you like it. Chicago's experimental rock band Cheer Accident has been around for 30 years and releasing albums for 20, with many changes of personnel and styles. But the key constant is founding member Tim Jones, who is a keyboardist, singer, and most important, a drummer. So from the start, Cheer Accident had the advantage of commitment to a firm rhythm attack and, as the band's name indicates, a slightly eye-rolling sense of humor. That didn't help much in the early years of abrasive sound as an end in itself, abrupt starts and stops, and rote Nirvana imitations. Cheer Accident got better at brainy elaborations and eventually turned out 22-minute workouts that were marvels of coherence, but no more emotionally engaging than the previous squawks and blats. But all along, a current was rising in the band's material. Harmonies, melodies, done with increasing affection and skill. On the latest album, No Ifs, Ands, or Dogs, Cheer Accident can make an otherwise ominous line, "I'll be the one to drag you down," sound almost sweet. The album includes lots of the group's characteristic puns and racket, including Drug You Down, a kind of satire of the harmonies on Drag You Down. However, No Ifs, Ands, or Dogs indulges in pleasure more than any previous release by the group. I hoped Cynical Girl might be a cover of the Marshall Crenshaw tune. It's not, but still pretty.
Cynical girl, why are you so scared? What in the world has made you frightened now? What life undone?
Among bands Cheer Accident recall, they are not as intellectually tight as Henry Cow nor as casually poetic as Soft Machine. But even if you don't know who those bands are, Cheer Accident is worth deliberate investigation.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. He reviewed the new albums from Cheer Accident and Battles. World War I brought unimaginable carnage to both soldiers and civilians. Our next guest, Adam Hochschild, explains why in his new book, To End All Wars. He also writes about the men and women who thought the war was madness, the war resistors, the men who refused the draft, and soldiers who refused to fight. The book focuses on England. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan says, quote, "Hochschild makes a reader feel anew the shock of modern technological warfare. He renders the pacifists' tales no less compelling than those of the soldiers in the trenches. He also enlarges on the question, what does it take for a person to shake off the shackles of conventional wisdom and think for him or herself? What punishments does society mete out? What apologies does posterity sometimes offer to those courageous enough to see things differently? Unquote. Hochschild's other books include King Leopold's Ghost and Bury the Chains. He spoke with Terry earlier this month.
Adam Hochschild, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with the human cost of World War I.
Well, it was enormous, Terry. More than 9 million military dead, probably between 10 and 12 million civilian dead, although we'll never know that number with any precision. And in addition, 21 million soldiers wounded, and many of them were permanently missing, you know, arms, legs, hands, genitals, or else, you know, driven mad by shell shock. There was also a human cost in a larger sense, in that I think the war remade the world for the worse in every conceivable way. It ignited the Russian Revolution. It laid the ground for Nazism and made the Second World War almost certain. It's pretty hard to imagine the Second World War without the First.
You're right that World War I was astonishingly lethal for officers, for the ruling classes in all the countries involved in the war. Why was that?
Well, this is one of the many things that has long fascinated me about the war. You know, if you look at the wars that our country has been involved in recent years, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, it's the poor who've done most of the dying. And usually throughout history, you know, elites are very good at getting somebody else to do the dying for them. But in the First World War, it was different. It was different because it was the tradition in most of the major countries for upper-class young men to have military careers. And then it became those young captains and lieutenants who led their men out of the trenches and into a hail of machine gun fire. And of course, they were conveniently distinguished for enemy sharpshooters because officers' uniforms were different from ordinary soldiers' uniforms. They carried pistols instead of rifles and so forth. And the toll was just colossal. For example, men who graduated from Oxford in 1913, 31% were killed.
That's amazing. That's an amazing statistic.
And, it, you know, people who waged the war, the prime ministers and cabinet ministers and so forth, the prime minister of England, Herbert Asquith, lost a son. The German chancellor lost a son. The chief of the British general staff on the Western Front lost two sons. His counterpart in the French army lost three sons. You know, the list could go on.
World War I is famous, among other things, for its trench warfare, where there was literally a front line and trenches of French and British on one side and Germans on the other. How did it become this type of trench warfare where nobody could move and territory wasn't gained?
Well, this took everybody by surprise, and there's a scholar who actually searched through a lot of British Army reports and came up with some extraordinary quotes from generals writing to each other in the first year or two of the war, saying, this war is not normal, and maybe soon we'll get to normal conditions. And what they were referring to was that the armies were stuck in place because this system of trenches facing each other, really for some 3 years, they barely moved more than a few miles in each direction. In 1915, for example, the Allies launched a number of major attacks. There were probably close to 1 million casualties on both sides. During the course of the year, the Allies gained exactly 7 square miles of territory. And the trenches evolved because the defensive weapons of the war, barbed wire, an entrenched machine gun nest, and a trench in the ground were so much stronger than the offensive weapons of the war, because to gain territory, you got to come out of your trench, move forward over open ground where you're exposed to enemy fire. And this was something nobody had planned for, even though they could have looked at other recent wars in history. You know, there was trench warfare at the end of the American Civil War, for example, around Richmond in Virginia. But they chose not to do that because they wanted to imagine glorious cavalry charges and the like. And, of course, there were none of those glorious cavalry charges.
What were some of the worst horrors of trench warfare?
Well, think about living underground for month after month after month. One problem, of course, is that the water table in most of Western Europe, at least where the fighting was, is fairly close to the surface of the ground. In parts of Belgium, the water table is only about 2 or 3 feet below ground. So this meant that a lot of the time the soldiers on each side were literally knee-deep in mud. You know, they rigged up pumps and so on to try to pump the water out of the trenches, but they were hopeless, especially when it rained. There was an enormous profusion of rats. There was the dreaded trench foot where, you know, if you go around in wet socks and leggings, you know, week after week, your feet begin to wither and rot. And it was a matter of essentially living underground, not a very pleasant place to live.
More than 20,000 British men of military age refused the draft during the course of the war. That's really a lot of people. Did England have anything like the American conscientious objector status, where you could decline serving if you could prove that it violated your religious practices?
They did. They actually had a fairly broad conscientious objector law, but many people were denied that status. And then even if you got the status, many people, as a matter of principle, refused to do the alternative service that was offered for conscientious objectors, which usually meant driving an ambulance at the front or working in a munitions factory or something like that. And as a result of those refusals, more than 6,000 young men in Britain went to prison. It was the largest number of people ever imprisoned up to that point in time in a Western democracy.
If you had to, generalize, what were some of the reasons that the war resistors were willing to be in prison rather than even serving in alternate service?
And keep in mind also that they were in prison under very harsh conditions, a bare-bones diet, the rule of silence where you were not allowed to talk to anybody. The prisons were extremely cold because there was a shortage of coal for heating, and of course the prisons were last in line to get that. The reasons that they refused were a mixture of religious and political. A majority of people who in Britain who applied for conscientious objector status did so citing religious convictions, most of them being Quakers, and a majority also cited political convictions, most of them being international socialists who felt like they didn't want to make war on their fellow socialists. And I think all of them, you know, felt this war was pointless. It was not being fought for any great moral purpose. Britain and France could not claim that they were fighting for democracy when they were colonial empires and when their principal ally was Tsarist Russia, which was the last absolute monarchy in Europe. So I think these were some of the things that led this very brave group of people to refuse service and to go to prison.
But Germany had declared war on France, so, you know, what do you do after that?
Well, I think this is one of the things that makes it morally complicated. Germany declared war on France and Belgium and invaded both of those countries. And I think you can understand why, you know, French and Belgian young men wanted to defend their countries, which indeed the overwhelming majority did want to do. But many people in England felt this should not be our fight. They thought this is going to be a very destructive war. We were not attacked. In fact, Germany went out of its way not to attack England at the beginning of the war. They didn't want British participation in the war. They thought Britain was not going to come in. They were alarmed and disappointed when it did. And it's true that German troops marched across neutral Belgium in their attack on France, but a few months later, British troops marched across a neutral country, China, in their attack on a German colony in China. So, and then, of course, all of the winning countries rather cynically divided up the territory of the losers when the war's end came. So nobody really came out of this with very clean hands, even though, as you say, Germany really did start the war.
There were anti-war rallies that were starting to draw big crowds by 1917. Did something happen to change popular opinion after a couple of years of war?
Well, I think The anti-war movement did seem to be gaining power in 1917, which was, of course, the third full year of the war, and the war had been, you know, occupied half of 1914 as well. Anti-war sentiment was gaining ground because people saw enormous, enormous battles that seemed to be fought for nothing. In 1917, just as the Battle of the Somme had been the big thing in 1916, there was another enormous battle, Passchendaele, which was very similar, you know, months and months of fighting for a tiny bit of ground. And also there was a defection in late 1917 from a key figure in the British establishment, Lord Lansdowne, former foreign minister. He'd actually presided over the making of the informal agreement with France before the war, which had led British troops to be engaged there. And he wrote a letter to the editor, which the London Times actually refused to publish, and so it had to appear in another paper, saying it's time to think about a negotiated peace. And the fact that someone high in the establishment was saying this was a new thing. So the anti-war movement definitely gained power during that year. Then what happened was in early 1918, the Germans launched an enormous offensive, which actually, by using new tactics, instead of this business of advancing in phalanxes, they advanced in sort of small detachments of stormtroopers. By using these new tactics, they actually broke through the trenches for the first time, gained an enormous amount of ground. And this sense of urgency that the decisive battle of the war was at hand actually put a damper on the anti-war movement. And even people who had deserted the army.
Because they thought they were maybe close to winning
or
close to losing?
Close to one or the other. But there, if you read the government intelligence reports on the dissidents of that period, you find as soon as the German offensive starts, a kind of upsurge of intelligence agents saying, now the workers are not protesting anymore. You know, there was a case in Scotland of a deserter who turned himself in so that he could fight against the new German offensive. Tragically, exactly the same thing happened in Germany. There had been a rash of strikes in munitions factories at the beginning of 1918. And, you know, that could have been the beginnings of an anti-war movement in Germany. There, too, once this enormous new offensive began and it seemed like the decisive battle of the war was at hand, most of that evaporated.
You know, in describing resistance to the war and people who refused to enlist and paid the consequences, you also write about men at the front who were in the army and then they wanted out. They couldn't do it anymore. And some of them were executed. Would you describe what happened to soldiers who felt they could no longer participate in the war?
Well, one of the fascinating controversies of recent years has been this. During the First World War, there were more than 300 British soldiers who were executed for desertion, laying down arms in the face of the enemy, running away in the face of an enemy attack, and so on, which is actually several times the number of German soldiers who were executed for similar offensives during the war. The Germans became far more draconian in World War II, of course. And there has been a long battle in England in recent decades about getting posthumous pardons for these men. And, you know, with anti-war people saying, well, anybody who deserted or laid down arms in the face of the enemy was making the right decision for the time. Plus, it's obvious a lot of these men were shell-shocked and really didn't know what they were doing.
In 1990, a citizens group was founded called Shot at Dawn, and they demanded a posthumous pardon for those resistors who were executed during World War I. And the British government gave a blanket pardon to more than 300 executed World War I soldiers. This was in 2006. Was that a widely publicized event in England? Was that a big deal in England in 2006?
It was quite a big deal because there'd been a controversy over it for some years. There are four or five books written about these executed soldiers, a couple of plays. The Army got a retired Army officer to co-author a book with someone else about these cases saying, well, you know, given the standards of the time when capital punishment was routine, you know, these cases were fairly judged and there should be no pardons. And then finally the men were pardoned, which I think was in a way a sort of symbolic gesture of the government acceding to the public mood in England, which I think now is one that considers this war a needless tragedy that should not have been fought.
And another way that we're literally still dealing with the consequences of World War I, and this is just a very tangible thing, there are still mines left over from that war that continue to kill people.
That's right. On the Western Front, which was not far from being the only front in the war, but it was the one that was most intensively fought over in such a small space, there were more than 700 million artillery and mortar rounds fired in 4.5 years. And it's estimated that about 15% of them were duds. You know, they didn't go off when they hit. Instead, they buried themselves deep in the ground. And they are going off all the time today. You know, somebody builds a fire in a forest on a camping trip or something, and it burns down and then sets off a buried artillery shell published, you know, that is sitting underneath there. When certain kinds of construction projects are done, in the early 1990s, there were 36 people killed in 1 year in France when they did the excavation for the new high-speed rail line that goes from Paris to the Channel Tunnel. And there have been more than 600 French bomb disposal experts, you know, who are specialists in finding and defusing these bombs, killed since 1945. Sometimes they find World War II bombs that didn't go off. Sometimes even from the Franco-Prussian War, because this was fought over the same territory too. But the vast majority of this unexploded ordnance is from the First World War. You see tractors with armor plate underneath the seats. You see yellow warning signs telling you to keep away from certain patches of forest.
Well, Adam Hochschild, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Adam Hochschild's latest book is called To End All Wars. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, and Heidi Simon. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.